of Israel. Yesterday, we did a little bit in the New Testament on that as well. But what I'm also trying to do is think about a ecological and spiritual dimension of the 21st century, and particularly in this larger place of the Cascade Mountains, to put together a way that we might also have some spiritual hold on what we can do as a part of the larger Earth community. And what we have done for most of this week in terms of the what we call the keystone species, which is a new biological approach to a whole bunch of ethical community. We have first done a big thing biologically that really took part mainly in Washington State for the past 50 years. And now we're actually honing in on what we call keystone species, or what the biologists call keystone species, in the Cascade Mountains themselves. I'm wanting to then ask the question, what are the main ethical, theological, and ecological dimensions of humans' life together, both in the ancient Jubilee world and in the contemporary world that's focused on keystone species. We'll be going back and forth on there. But at the beginning of our time, and John and I had a particularly really helpful conversation in our first question, I raised, because I'm wanting to raise spiritual and theological questions as well about our day, I've been raising the question about how one can think about both of those at the same time. That is, the ancient Jubilee. It's not just ancient, because of course Jews have practice of Jubilee still in some cases, as do some Christians. So first, I want to go over what we've been talking about in the Jubilee, and let me repeat what I think was incomplete approach to Jubilee. One of the things I've been saying all week long is there's tons of material about Jubilee in mostly the First Testament, also a little bit the Second Testament, but it's poorly organized, is what I've said. And I, to a certain extent, stand by that, because you have it, for instance, in some of the writings of wisdom. We have some prophets. We have a lot in Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. And for instance, we've been looking primarily at Leviticus 25. And what we found out, interestingly enough, is something that scholars have found for a long time, is the real key picture of Jubilee is in chapter 25, and it has nothing to do with chapter 26 or chapter 24. And so last night I felt like it was important for us to say a little bit more than this is, like much of the Bible, weirdly organized. It's not that it's the only place that that happens. But I think that in this handout, which is basically a scholarly handout on Leviticus 25, it seems to me that when I read it the fifth time, it gave us some more help to think about this. And that was, instead of there being just a whole bunch of different laws and rules in a kind of a random order, what I think is happening is that, so one of the main phenomena that we have seen all week long is what the Jubilee wants to do is over a period of 50 years give a way of being ecological for the people of Israel, having a bunch of commandments that make sense to what the people of Israel can do together to basically serve the land which God owns for agriculture. And what we have noticed around the edges is that it was really hard to do that well for the people of Israel. Mainly because, of course, some of you probably been to Israel. Israel is not really good agricultural territory.
It's kind of like Holden?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it looks like half of the time Israel can do a relatively good job of having agriculture in the land. But often there's not enough water, and often the soil is not great. So no wonder Israel, for its 800 years before Jesus arrived and afterwards, no wonder the big empires all around kept conquering Israel. It simply doesn't have a great ecology or economy. And so what we kept running into this week was how many times the people of Israel would have to make slaves of one another. So many times other people around the edges would make slaves of them. In other words, real key information that things weren't going well. Now, there are some places in the Bible which say, oh, that's because there's just such bad people. I'm pretty sure that that is not a complete answer. One has to even feel bad about having to live in that land where things are not great. And what it turns out is we were, during the week when we were looking at especially Leviticus 25, we would find places where, well, what do you do if these people are slaves, but they're really kin of one another? And one of the things, that, of course, was this relative order that Israel and especially Jubilee had made, that is, use a system of 7 years at a time. And one of the things that they did stunningly was, okay, work on that land for 6 years, and then just give it a break so that it can get better in the seventh year. Do that for seven times of 7 years. And then, in the 50th year, just really make a big effort to forgive everybody because you've been on each other's backs for a long time. Let the earth really rest in the 50th year, and let you rest and keep thinking about forgiving one another for the hard times you've had together. Now, on Wednesday, I gave you a 20-minute short survey of the social structure of Israel in that time. And that was mainly three levels of the way one organizes oneself as an Israelite. One is in very tiny agricultural communities, usually led by a father. This usually wasn't just a nuclear family, but a couple of nuclear families. And it more or less had the same family and the same father. And he led the land. He tried to make clear how the commandments would help make life better together and life better on the land. But at the same time, you have, and you guys have this handout, I'm not sure if I did it well enough. The second thing you have in Israel are clans. We had a great discussion on how those clans probably, in many ways, might have some similarity to clans in America. I'm not talking about the southern clans, I'm talking about the native clans. And so a clan was a bigger territory, a bunch of father territories. And then there are tribes in Israel, which are even bigger things. That, so you would have a bunch of clans make up a tribe. It turns out, about 11:30 last night, that I read this carefully again, and what they said is, in those hard times that you went through for 7 years or 50 years, there are three ways that you can have some help. Sometimes the father's families can follow some of the commandments that will help forgive one another, help forgive debt, and help give the land a break. But sometimes that unit is so mixed up and hurt that you have to turn to the clan, which has a little bit more power. But sometimes the clans are in disruption, and you have to go to the tribe. Interestingly enough, you never went completely up the scale to the monarch. Mainly because, of course, as we've said all week long, the people in the country don't trust the people in the city. And the people in the city have been doing poorly to help the countryside. So here is a little bit of hope, I think, in figuring out the Jubilee. In other words, those rules, those values, you're trying to do that at the family level, at the clan level, and at the tribe level. And in many cases, it's hard for one or the other to do it. So you then lean into the best level of structure during the 7s and the 50s. Okay, well, I'm proud of it after 11:30 last night, but let's take a moment to see if you have any other questions about how, because one of the things we've been saying all week long is, why are there's so many rules and so many ways to get out of jams?
I have a question, sure. That begins at the beginning. So I don't want to make what you've got planned digress or anything like that. I wanted to know, if this land was so lousy, why were there conquering people for that land? Was it just like Ukraine and Russia said, this, you used to be part of my thigh or whatever, my hip, I want you back?
Great question, and easily answered, I think, in contrast to some of these this week. Basically, the main thing that Israel had on its side is it had the main thoroughfares between all the other empires. And so you had to go through them. So for instance, a lot of times, say, let's say the Hittites and the Egyptians are really are big empires that are on each other's case. But if you're going to do anything about that on one side or another, you got to take Israel. Happened over and over again. So it's not only not great land, but great authors on all sides. Or not great empires on all sides. And that, which are always knocking Israel down. So that's not good territory and really powerful enemies. Yeah, I mean, we, of course, for instance, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, is one of the main parts of Israel's entire ancient history, because all three of those were just taking over Israel a lot. Yes, John.
So, I mean, you kind of touched on this a little bit, but was there any, like, evidence that any of this even happened? I mean, like, in theory, some of it makes sense. Like, you know, like, okay, nobody owns the land in perpetuity, and after 50 years, it goes back to God, and then it's redistributed. But in practice, that, like, it doesn't actually seem logical, and it doesn't seem like anybody ever actually, like, did it. I mean, after 50 years, yeah, okay, it's God land, but I'm still here.
That's great. And of course, we started with that because many of the scholars of this have said lots of stuff on the Jubilee, but never in all of the texts, never one saying, you know, when we did that.
Remembrance.
And what the scholars say is that means that was... And this is where I would lean toward it, I think, that before Israel had kings for about 300 years, when Israel says we're basically tribes that work together. In those 300 years, when you don't have a central monarchy, that looks like the way a family, clan, and tribe would best do work together, especially on the land. So if it happened, it probably happened before the monarchy, and then very much later, I would say, the scholars say mainly from the fifth through the third century BCE, after having been conquered many times, you started to get nostalgic for some way forward. And most of the time you're being conquered anyway, but then you start writing again about this. So, for instance, a lot of Leviticus actually wasn't written until the 4th century. And so that meant... Some scholars say they weren't doing it anymore, but they were wishing they could do it. They were doing it mainly because they weren't even in charge of their own country. That's my best educated guess. But for us to say what you said, John, is exactly right, and that is we have to think of this as value of the people of Israel, wish of the people of Israel, dream of the people of Israel, occasionally work of the people of Israel.
So in reading the materials, there was a section, and I don't know if you've touched on it, but you know, when you think of 50 years, it's a whole generation. So, you know, it's like who owns what piece in their slaves, and that are within families, but then I don't know if they're intermarried in these clans or tribes, but so then if they start all over again and take it back to the original, like how do you even know who the original owners of certain sections were with all that going on? But it said it was to free the next generations. kind of idea. So it's just interesting to imagine how that's all working out.
Oh, that's really just right on with the text. Because in the middle of almost every text you'll say, in case you can't wait until 50 years or 7 years, you can do it now. Anything. In other words, they say, this is our big, these are our values on the land. And if you're in such trouble, now, and you can't wait for the clan, or you can't wait for the tribe, or the father of the local family is screwing up, or something like that. Please try to do some of these practices now.
Just they'll make sure you have a good attorney.
they'll even say very clearly, you don't have to wait to forgive somebody's debt.
Interesting.
You can do it any time, and God likes it.
The person with the debt, can, the person at the top can do it, not the person at the bottom.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Right. Right.
At the same time, property ownership did pass down. As we know, it was a male hierarchy. We also know that a lot of those sections that we kind of skip over with all the begats and stuff, some of those begats are actually to show who owns what land. Some of those begats were more to show maybe my greatest grandfather was somebody historical. When it says my son, his son, his son, some of those people are female, some of those people were uncles. So the way we read it, but some of this stuff was designed just to show property ownership. So if it was really doing that, I'm not sure how serious they would be at doing Jubilee and giving some of it away. Because we're really kind of showing that we've been there and it's been in our clan, our tribe, for a long time.
Absolutely. In other words, that matter of fact, we have texts that say, we can't do this with the cities over us. Mm. We just simply can't do it. So, anyway, this is a fun thing that, you know, that the Jubilee for this summer's program was it. It was mainly because, as I understand it, Holden really wanted to do some ecology scripture. And this is the biggest ecology scripture you've got, which was kind of a mess.
Well, it seems like at the core, Jubilee is, you know, forgiveness, giving back. It's a recognition we don't own this land, but still there's a sense of generosity it's a basic spiritual principle, really. So right. Whether or not we ever had it, they ever had it, or whatever. I mean, it's a call to us to be generous. Really, if it means anything at all, it seems like. But, I mean, it gets kind of challenging because, let's take Holden Village. So it's the Jubilee. So what are we going to give back? Are we going to give back a whole section of our property to, you know, the natives who we probably eventually took it from somehow? You know, or are we going to say to all the staff, well, you're free. You work for us for nothing or something. I mean, the actuality of it is, it's hard. I mean, it's really hard because if you've worked hard for 50 years to attain something and then you just say, well, I'm going to give it all away, that's a big challenge. At the core, a spiritual challenge that nobody would probably relish, but maybe it's a call, it's an invitation.
Yeah, thank you. Then therefore, I would say that from time to time in Christian history, they say, why don't we do that? Why don't we like to think we could do that? There, the Christians have a bigger problem because they didn't have a national structure, a tribal structure or a clan structure, and they didn't have land together, and didn't have the concept of God being the owner of their land. And then the other thing, of course, that we said, I guess it was on Tuesday and Wednesday, I was pointing out that if one, in terms of Holden, we looked at the gray wolves that turns out are much more positive sources in the Cascade Mountains than almost anything else. And then we realized, what if we kind of gave something back to the gray wolves? And then we had great arguments in trying to think about how one might give that generosity to the people of this land who went, or not the people, but the beings that were on this land before.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the aspect of Jubilee right now, when the Biden administration has offered forgiveness of student loans, and the resentment of that is the pushback, and how we might theologically think about that, even in our sermons and Bible studies and conversations in the church, because it is a Jubilee concept, and yet it's being pushed back against by Christians and Jews and, you know, everyone else. It just kind of struck me that is a form of Jubilee in a way. And thinking about the comment last night during worship, you know, the loan that the government will never expect to get repaid.
Right. Right.
Anyway,
that's beautiful. In that, to have a scripture that says, either every 7 years or every 50 years, give every debt away.
Yeah.
That is a powerful value that would be best if one didn't forget.
I think about the struggle that I have, and it sounds like some of us are having, about how this would work, and that over the years and people's population growth and all that sort of stuff. And I also think about our system, where there's more and more wealth concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, and in the system, in a sense, how our system is not serving, in a sense, justice for people, for the poor. More and more, it's becoming that way. And so, I'm not sure what the system is that works, that provides some or enough, at least, for all.
Yeah, and there, I at least what the historical scholars say is that the Jubilee can work better on the land rather than in the city. Once the city starts making a big thing of it, all of that forgiveness thing is really much more difficult. And we're up the wazoo as a country in that kind of power.
Mm-hmm. But just like, I don't know, maybe combining these two comments here, we also see that sort of like dissonance and inequality when it comes to like debt as well. Because, you know, you're saying like those student loans, there's such a huge uproar about it, but when they forgave, I think it was way more in those PPP loans that they gave away to businesses at the pandemic, to the upper class of people, and then they just forgave all of them, and there wasn't a word about it with anybody. They're like, yeah, well, rich people can get their debts forgiven, that's perfectly fine, but these students, they took that money, they need to pay it back. And it's like, where do you get this kind of disconnect just because you're talking about different classes of people generally?
Yeah,
here, you know?
Makes me think.
It's a really weird, I mean, even when it comes to these debts and forgiveness of debts, like, we don't want to do it for the people that we have subjugated already, you know?
Absolutely. And I just want to sort of say my sins here. I just think my best PhD student in Bible forever still has $120,000 that she owes.
Wow.
And she's been out of school for 12 years.
And when my first wife had cancer and would get chemotherapy, she'd sit in a room with other people who were getting it, and they would tell stories about how they were mortgaging their homes,
yeah,
and cashing into retirement to stay alive.
Just to stay alive.
Yeah.
To stay alive.
Yeah. Well, this is really a powerful question, looking historically back, and thank you for staying with us. This is where I thought when I said, okay, I'm going to do, or I volunteered to do, the Jubilee for a week. Then I learned that it was 1 hour a day for 4 days. And I thought, well, we may not get finished then.
But we got started.
Yeah, we're getting started. And I want to do a little bit more on the keystone species. And again here, just to say, for some of you who haven't been, you know, all of this, about 45 years ago, a bunch of biologists discovered, really around the world, in certain places, there are certain species that actually make the area that the ecology for certain areas. There is one species that does about half of the work and makes all of the other species fit together way more. And we studied the sea otters for the first day just to get a clue of this, and then I had found over the summer, I had found 5 keystone species in the Cascades. And so we looked at the wolves. We looked yesterday for an instant at the beavers. I'm going to just show you some pictures and things that are amazing about the beaver. Where is the beaver? So I won't do all of this, but it turns out that one of the things that the beavers do around the world, but there's more beavers still around in the United States and Canada than many places in the world. And these are creatures that basically build spaces that many other animals can go into and thrive on without the beaver saying, get out of here. So there are tons of all kinds of species for the beaver, and the beaver, as I understand it, from this summer, is the beavers were less successful century ago in Washington than they are now. They're coming back, just like the wolves, just like the otters. So that's a really interesting thing. And the one for the beavers, this has been somewhat like the otters on the west coast on the peninsula. It's one of the first times that humans are participating in the cooperation in real ways, so that the beavers' places with all these different animals are getting better and bigger and more. And of course, there are then people who say, hey, you're messing with my suburban territory, or my roads, or something like that. I'm saying this is pretty cool that finally humans, in many cases, even governmentally, are starting to actually just so that the animals can do better, not so that the humans can watch them or anything like that. They have, my research had a whole bunch of things that said the landscapes that the beavers are taking now are often ones that nobody else wants. And so they say, allow your eyes to follow the barren, charred out, post-apocalyptic landscape. Let your eyes wander down the hill to what looks like might be a ravine. Look closer. That ravine is actually a wetland. That wetland is a pond, and that pond has bog plants and shrubs and even trees that survived the fire. Look even closer. Right in the center on that wetland is a dam and a domed beaver lodge. Around that lodge is a small surviving wetland that is teeming with life, fish, insects, reptiles, other mammals, all of whom survived the fire, all of whom will live on to play their part in the regeneration of the forest that burned down around them. So, I mean, I couldn't, as I was, as I guess it was about 3 months that I discovered this thing, I thought, wow, what would it be like on this valley to make more beavers possible? And I know that there are beavers in the Cascade Mountains in other places. I don't know that there are any now. Has anyone seen beaver up this way?
See a mountain beaver.
And what is that?
Mountain beaver, it's another
the
road.
Oh, yes, the little one. Yes.
Down in, you know, Donkey Lake, various places.
Uh-huh. So there's lots more to this about what the damming and the pool of the family home is really just beginning. One of the other really amazing things is the similar to the otter is the beaver are amazing physical creatures. They have, I mean, it's actually the otters have apparently the warmest fur in all mammals. The beaver are in second place on that. And they have two different layers of fur, I mean, really almost two different furs, so that they can be in the water in the way they are. And then they take all kinds of trees, knock them down, but what happens out of all of that is, first of all, that's their food, as well as their building, and that actually builds, that makes other kinds of plants and trees grow anyway, so, or even more. So it's a pretty amazing thing, just very much like we saw in the otters on Tuesday. Yes?
I just want to add that another important aspect of beavers and their dams is that they slow down the water coming down the stream, and so when there's a big flood or something, it moderates how much flooding happens downstream from these dams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And those pools are good for fish, too. One thing in that description, and this has nothing to do with what you're talking about, we've changed the meaning of words. So to me, to say post-apocalyptic, I mean, a lot of people nowadays use apocalypse as something bad. The apocalypse, according to St. John, was not bad. It's looking through the veil dimly. It's Armageddon and the end times that everybody's talking about. So I always react when I see that.
Thank you for that. Nothing like getting some of our words cleaned up. That's wonderful. Well, I want to just say a little bit about some of these creatures that we haven't gotten to. You may have seen in Vespers last night, I prayed for all of them. But And I mentioned the snowshoe air. And you may have seen, and actually in my prayer last night, I said why these are keystone species. It's hilarious. And it's very different than the beaver. And it's because they are so amazing at how they can make so many little hairs.
In other words, they provide food for some of these
creatures.
There's a lot of the creatures you picked are more the top end of the chain.
Yeah, so these are not the predators. They're in a different kind of species in which what they do is they make food, meaning little hairs, and they survive mightily. In other words, by and large, they are out there making babies all the time. Many other animals are just eating them up, and that's fine in terms of this, the way, the, how much they grow. So it's very interesting that the otters, the wolves, the beaver, all have been named actually officially by governmental places as keystone species, but they go about it differently. And so what the analysis is not what are they doing, but how are they making their own place bigger, more diverse for all kinds of living things. So I had to smile to myself while I was praying last night about celebrating all of the dead bunnies.
The dead bunnies. I have to say this. Or Dennis just said, he says, it's the manna. It's manna.
Yeah, it is.
It's manna. Little bunny.
Or it's like the quail, because they had both the quails and the manna.
Mm-hmm. Then we did the gray wolf the other day. There's the beaver. This thing was stunning to me. I guess it was in about May of this year when I was studying that the hummingbirds are known worldwide as keystone species, and the main thing they do around the world is pollination. In other words, we couldn't be the plant havens that we are, all those things that plants do, without this. This is the tiniest bird that lives.
They're also insectivores. They're insectivores also, half their diet is insects.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing that I learned just this week is there's some reading that I ran across here on campus that talked about in generations before how many people had hummingbird things on their houses in the mining period. Mm-hmm. So really, really interesting for that. Then there's this one.
Just curious. I would have thought honeybees would have also been on that list. Maybe it is, and you just think.
I only got to five.
First of all, honeybees are not native. Honeybees cannot pollinate Western Hemisphere plants. All of our native bees can pollinate 100 times as many flowers as any honeybee. So honeybees are not keystone.
Okay.
Maybe in Europe.
How about other kind of bees?
Well, we have, right around here, we have like 500 kinds of bees. Bumblebees is the most predominant because they last through the whole summer. A lot of our bees, 70% of the bees live in the ground. So a lot of them come out in May, June, or whatever. so they're seasonal. So
and how about butterflies? It seems like monarchs are kind of on the decline, and
the problem
that's
with
sad, but I don't know if they do something besides just provide beauty.
Bees, a lot of bees are, have the flower constancy principle, where they go from one flower head to another of the same species, so they actually really pollinate it so you get seeds. This is, honeybees don't do this, neither do butterflies, because if a butterfly goes from an aster to something else, it's not going to pollinate. So they're not as efficient. I'm not saying they don't, but the bees are truly what you do.
Isn't this a conversation just great like the wolves one? We had a whole bunch of people in the room who knew about wolves and how they were in their neighborhood and how that was going. It's a fascinating thing. And again, frankly, I up there, Holden person, it would be lovely to have another another summer of us thinking through what where the keystone species are in the greater Cascades. But anyway, this one, this is of course, and I suspect because in June it's a whole bunch of research on the grizzlies in the Cascades. And so here's the, as I understand it, what is, there are hardly any left. There are some left. There have been major legal and governmental efforts to bring them back. And in as I understand it, it has not done well at the ballot box or in the legislature. But here's the thing that I learned about. There's a lot of studies, mostly, of course, in Yellowstone. But there, what they're finding out is they're not the monsters that we think. It is true that some people are killed by grizzlies, but grizzlies are mostly they do eat some other species, but they mostly are vegetative in what they eat, and this is what I quoted last night in the prayer. One of the main things they do is they make the soil better. They drag bodies around and leave them there to change the soil. And one of the things they're learning is that that grizzlies are amazingly contributing to the larger health of most of the species. Now I thought they're just killing things, but on both the vegetative level and the what they do, for instance, is they one of the things I think I've learned this year is they mostly like to kill mammals that are already wounded. And that what that does is that makes the other parts of those species stronger. Their herds are better because, that's what I've read, because the grizzlies call the other species.
Basically, you're correct. They're omnivores. And they'll go out and dig grubs. You can watch them in Yellowstone digging grubs. So you tear up the soil and you circulate. That's correct. Can't remember what else I was going to say.
Okay, thank you. There's plenty more that I could say about this, but as you all know from this week, I like us to be talking with each other as much as possible. And what's clear is, in many cases around here, I come in and say, I want to learn some things about the species in the Cascade Mountains, and I'm not a Cascade Mountainer, except for the 13 times I've been here. So anyway, just stepping back and thinking about the dimensions of the keystone species is, for me, this wonderful thing that basically builds communities of non-humans. And around the edges now, we have some humans helping with it. It seems to me like that, well, what I learned in a longer study with my grandson on the sea otters, we went to see the sea otters at the Olympics, and it was, they're 6 million years old. And they had, at the beginning of the downturn of the sea otters in the 1700s, because of the boats from the eastern coast and from the Russian coast and the Chinese coast, they all came in and basically almost eliminated the species. My 12-year-old grandson read more stuff about it, and he learned about this, the intelligence of them. So it turns out that, to a certain extent, some people are keystone species, partly because they're so smart, and they do so. What they do in the water, with the, for instance, what the beavers do in the water, is often because of how smart they are. Musings about that. You know, the great thing about this week for me is the other class that was on basically the environment was on the politics of it, which I was so glad that we were learning about. But here is, for me, both a spiritual and a collective kind of way also to think about ways that humans can have other kinds of space in the larger earth and world. Yes.
It seems like in order to bring these things back to their proper place, humans have to put up with a little inconvenience, like more hair is probably, your garden's going to get eaten, and more foxes or animals, they're going to get some pests occasionally, or your chickens or whatever, and I don't know, the hummingbirds seem to be pretty innocuous, but the bears are going to take some livestock and things like that, so we have to see that there's a benefit and put up with some loss ourselves, I guess.
That's beautiful, yeah, because from my point of view, this is going and this is growing and not growing. There are a number of states now that, for instance, whenever a wolf or a bear kills livestock, they get paid by us citizens for that. That seems to me, that's a pretty amazing way forward for us. But I know that in some states they stopped doing that because they just want to eliminate those species.
What I was also going to say was you're basically correct that in the lower 48 and even Canada, to lower Canada, the grizzlies do not eat large live creatures. They go after dead and dying creatures. They eat fish out of the rivers. But don't go to Denali tracking the grizzlies, because you are prey up there.
Yeah.
That's a different grizzly, and it's a different way of life than the lower 48 grizzlies. All the grizzly killings we've ever had were, it's a long story, but mostly bears that got totally friendly somehow with people, and people didn't take precautions. So if anybody wants to discuss the 68 grizzly killings or anything, I'll be glad to.
Thank you. John?
I imagine, I mean, with just a couple minutes left here, that you're one of your goals is to get us to relate this to our own communities and our own organizations that we're a part of. And while these people, I mean, these are all part of a natural ecosystem, you know, we as humans, we create our own ecosystems of organizations with particular goals and things that we're trying to accomplish. And, you know, if you're able to, you know, I look at this like almost dream team of an organization here is what this would be. If you're able to get people that fill all of these particular roles in your organization and do it to the efficiency and effect that each of these can do, where you have somebody who is capable of, you know, taking out your kind of lesser competitors in or people that you're going against in some ways to allow your organizations to grow, and people that are good at multiplying themselves and
cloning themselves.
In a less biological way than these, obviously. Or creating these structures that people are able to thrive within, or being mutualists that are able to go between organizations and get things done, you know. And then I don't know what the word you had for the bear was, but because they're kind of a little bit of a floater, it seems like.
Mm-hmm. So where I don't get is the victims, the hares.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're not breeding them as victims, I suppose. Yeah, just as food and fodder for your bath, I guess. But so much is. I don't know. I guess how you would relate that to an organization, you know, sort of a workhorse that can draw people into the organization, not to be, you know, picked off for the good of the rest of the people, but like you do need people that multiply themselves for different, you know, obviously in an organization. But you know, that's an important role. Yeah. I mean, you don't need them for the same reason as the hair, I guess, but it is an important role for its own purpose in your organization. I don't know if you can.
I was alluding to this the other day. The biological folks are really just getting started with this study. I mean, it's just only 50 years old in this study. And what I was saying earlier this week. Whoops!
Oh, cord.
they were. Yeah, they have already been able to see, in terms of this kind of larger phenomenon of keystone species, they've already now gotten the three main predators, or no, three main kinds. One, predators. One, what they call ecosystem engineers. So for instance, the beaver is one of a whole bunch of species that basically have inbred into them what they call engineering. And then others, there are what they call the mutualists, and those are species that accidentally end up living together. And instead of beating each other up, they learn how to build a larger place where a bunch of other species can do things together. And John, I think, yes, I like your analogy of people doing similar things, but frankly, I'm really interested in how we might actually make gestures of those kind toward the species as well. But that, I think your characterization that this may be a long way off is an interesting one as well. I have once again come up short in that I didn't get back to a little bit more of our talk about the work of God in this kind of way, or how the divine can be a part of this larger earthen task.
But I think it is implicit.
Very implicit. And frankly, one of the things I did for today that we're out of town time on, but when I look carefully at the Bible, since I'm mainly a Bible guy, when I look carefully at the way there are creatures of the divine in the Bible, they're not all just almighty gods. I mean, if you for instance, if you have a spectrum of saviors, often the saviors are actually not completely divine. Angels are kind of in between. There are humans that are almost gods in a good way. And so it seems to me as if there's a way in which our thinking about God is a little bit more caricaturistic than the Bible. The Bible has all kinds of sort of gods that are on the right side. I just did a paper on the saviors in the Bible. And it turned out that there are more saviors in the Bible that are human than God. Or, better put, that might be half human and half God. In other words, the saviors often in the Bible are real people that do wonderful things to bring people together and save people from destruction.
And sometimes they're flawed peoples too.
They're always flawed people.
We're all flawed.
Well, and you know, and then I had a whole big thing about the Gospel of Mark and Jesus. Jesus's story in the Gospel of Mark ended with Jesus saying from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Mm-hmm. In other words, you have a vulnerable God in the Gospel of Mark, where it's not all almighty power that actually saves. Okay, so I did what I could have done in 20 minutes in 3.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for thinking.
It was as if I could see a physical burden left off his shoulders. He had told me how he had carried this burden for years. You know, he was the only sibling. He was her older brother. And so that